Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Good afternoon, good evening, good morning, whatever time it is in the world, wherever you're tuning in from. We are getting towards the latter stages now of the Indian Wells tournament in the desert in California. And it's a great pleasure for me to introduce to you Steve Flink once again.
Hi, John. Nice to be back with you.
Every time it's sort of the time window between our meetings gets a little shorter. I think I sort of probably said to you a couple of months ago, let's talk about the French Open. And then it's like, yeah, but Indian Wells, it's the fifth slam. Who knows? We may squeeze you in during the Olympics. Are you going to the Olympics, by the way?
No, I'll be at Wimbledon. I will not be at the Olympics. I'll be following it closely, but I will not be over there.
Fair enough. All right. Before we get into other Indian Wells related stuff, I want to begin with Novak Djokovic, just because I think it's a storyline that we're still just about clinging to. Of course, he's recently withdrawn from Miami, the reasons for which are not super clear, but I guess we can draw our own conclusions. Before we look at maybe even that specific element, let's just talk about the match against Nardi and maybe just some question marks about his form in 2024, Steve.
Yeah, he was very critical. He thought he played very, very badly. You know, he was blunt about that as he was about his performance against Sinner in the semis of the Australian Open. Very different kind of a problem, because against Sinner, obviously, he was just, for two sets, he couldn't find the court. He just really was making a ton of unprovoked mistakes and was beating himself, and Sinner was rock solid, and it was finally, he got a little better, but lost in four. Here, obviously, you're playing a lucky loser. You know how those guys react. I think the reason he was so perturbed when it was over was that he knew there was just no way. It's not a match. It's just, he shouldn't have felt that he was under that kind of pressure. It was a subpar performance in a totally different way, John, is I guess what I'm getting at. It wasn't that he was making a ton of unforced errors, but he was making them at the wrong times. I mean, I noticed it from the outset. Obviously, he lost the first one, came back and won the second, lost in three. First set, in the first four service games of Nardi, he had either deuce or 30 all.
Okay.
All four games. Somehow, he just didn't pounce. I felt like it was there for the taking. And then amidst it all, he plays a loose game on his serve and lets it get away at two all. 40-15 he had, and he let that game get away, which was very costly because it was the only break of the set. Then you thought, I imagine you did too, John, felt the way I did, when Djokovic won the second set, despite the incident with the where he was so upset with the umpire because he felt that Nardi had stopped. It was an apparent double fault that wasn't a double fault because obviously the electronic lines. I can see why Nardi, as the ball landed, it was dangerously close. And it looked like it could have been long, but obviously you don't hear a call. So we know that Nardi in that instance, he kind of half stopped. He didn't completely stop. Stopped and then started moving again, and Novak was thrown off. He hit a drop shot. Then he stopped, and Nardi passed him. And obviously he wanted the umpire to call hindrance. It wasn't going to happen. He was wrong in this instance. I can see why he felt like he had been wronged, and he was in some senses, but the rule is the rule, and you weren't going to win that argument. But despite that, I mentioned that moment because that was a 2-love in the second set. He had finally broken Nardi, and he's trying to get to 3-love, and he loses the game. But then he still won the set 6-3. He broke again. Yeah. You know, it was not a problem. It didn't end up being costly, that lost service game, because he broke again and nearly broke an additional time, won the set 6-3. And you had to feel going into the third that this was going to be a fairly routine third set for him. It wasn't that at all. He was very tight. He nearly lost his opening service game and eventually got, you know, he did get broken and the one break was it. And he never came close against Nardi. I think he was upset because, yes, I mean, even in the third, one more instance I want to mention is that he's down 4-2 and he just been broken, gets it back. He has love 30. And you kind of had the feeling there, okay, if he breaks here and gets back on serve, yeah, his experience and his match playing prowess and his clutchness, if I may say, would get him through. And it didn't. He just didn't come close. The 4-2 opportunity got away. The love 30 opportunity got away and he loses. You saw the press conference, I'm sure, and he was very hard on himself. Mm-hmm. And I think, therefore, it's not shocking to me that he's not playing Miami, because I think he wants to clear his head. And I think he probably thought to himself, look, why do I have two choices. I could try to get right back on the horse, go to Miami and see if I can really get this season turned around, which is still very young for him. It was his, he's played three events, but that was only his second tournament. He played the team event prior to the Australian Open where he lost to Di Minaur, but won a couple of matches, semis of Australia. And then this one here. So, you know, he's 8-3 match record for the year. It's not up to his normal standards, but he just hasn't played enough. So in one sense, I thought, okay, maybe you just get back on the horse and try to make amends quickly in Miami. But perhaps he is thinking the better choice is, no, get started, get ready on the clay now. Just start training on clay and start in Monte Carlo, really determined and knowing that you're going to play a bunch of clay court tournaments and you'll get the matches you need to try to peak at the French Open. So I don't think it's that big a deal. I can see why he'd be torn. On the one hand, get right out there and why can't you do him? If you get on a roll in Miami, you might win there. But on the other hand, that would make the transition to clay a little bit tougher if he plays Miami. So I think he was just very upset with himself. That's the bottom line. And it was, frankly, an inexplicable loss.
Yeah, I like the expression used about clearing his head, because I think most of us have come to that conclusion more than even something physical. Although when you throw in the fact that Miami basically ends and the clay court season actually kind of in Europe at least begins, yeah, the next day,
right?
With Estoril, but of course he's not going to be playing Estoril, but Monte Carlo is only another week later, and it's
right.
It's a pretty. It does add to that stretch, but I do get the impression, like you do, that it's a clear the head decision, which is quite unusual for most tennis players. But I'm not sure, a couple of days late when the announcement was made, maybe it didn't come as that big a shock.
No, I mean, yeah, it's not. It's not a big shock. I think he's so aware. Also, it's funny how it works. Here's a guy that plays 12 tournaments last year, wins 7 of them. That's 3 Grand Slam titles, nearly a fourth, where he's in the final of Wimbledon and he's 1 set away. And perhaps 1 point away if he doesn't miss the swing volley. So on top of that, he wins 2 Masters 1000s. He wins the year-end championships. It was a spectacular year. Yeah. And that's not that long ago. So I think he feels the reverberations because everybody else is making such a big deal, especially since it was such a subpar performance against Sinner in Australia. If he'd lost to Sinner 7-5 in the fifth, the talk might have been very different. But he feels all that. And then I think what really irked him, John, was, as you know, he got to California a couple weeks early. He brought his family over. He was around LA a lot. He was training a lot. I think he was taking this tournament very seriously and thought to himself, okay, this is where I jumpstart my season. I'm coming back to Indian Wells for the first time in 5 years, and I'm going to win it. I think that was his attitude. And then to lose a match like this, it's such a rare loss, worst loss he's ever had at a Masters 1000 or a slam, you know, to lose to a lucky loser who I believe was 123 in the world. I mean, that's not him. And it's not the kind of player. I mean, I thought he made Nardi look so much better in the third set than Nardi really is, because he was so tight himself. So, yeah, I don't think it's that big. I don't sense there's any, you alluded to injuries. I don't think there was no indication of any injury. Physically, he looked fine. But as he said, he had nothing on his ball. He wasn't aggressive enough. He was playing too defensively in that match. And I think the problem, again, that people forget is that he's got this history of inordinate struggling, I would say, for a player of his caliber in the wind. I mean, Rafa's more comfortable in the wind. Roger's more comfortable in the wind. And I think he alluded to the wind after the match, not using it as an excuse, but he said it was much windier than it had been for when he practiced for the tournament or in his opening match. So that was also a factor because you could see him not. I've never been fond of the expression pull the trigger, but it's part of the tennis vernacular now, so I'll use it. And he didn't feel like he could pull the trigger. You could see it. And the finishing shots were not there. That was really handicapping him. He should have been able to cope with it better, but those were the circumstances. That was the reality. So there were so many factors. But obviously, worst case scenario, he should have won that match in three sets. Worst case. So that's why he's so upset, is that you can struggle with anybody, but you can't lose to somebody on that level.
There's one more point on Novak that's sort of coming across to me, but I can't quite join the dots exactly. And it's an impression more than anything scientific. But what I've seen, I remember Novak 2 or 3 years ago when he'd already got year-end number one sort of done and him sort of checking out of a particular match. I think it was in Vienna in a 250. And it was like, you know, I just think that Novak is probably slightly more susceptible to this than maybe Rafa is, for example, of the job is done now. And I've been watching him for 6 months since the slam race and arguably the GOAT debate as well is done too. And I've been watching him quite closely since that year-end finals. I think he was desperate at the Davis Cup, so probably would include that in this and then move on from there. I've seen him super relaxed, super happy, arriving, as you said, in California 2 weeks before. I think it was, of course, with the intention of winning this tournament, but just so at ease with himself away from the court. And even on the court, you mentioned it when I spoke to you before, when that loss to Sinner, when he wins that third set, we didn't see the scream and the "I'm dialed in." I've just written that expression down about being dialed in. And I just wonder if, when matches have been slipping away from him against Dimonor, Sinner, and now this match with Nardi, whether, you know, there's no Rafa there, there's no Carlos, or even a Yannick to some extent. Of course, one of those defeats was against him. But, you know, Carlos reinvigorated him. Rafa and Roger drove him on for the best part of two decades. And even probably the most motivated tennis player of all time cannot be dialed in 100% of the time. And I'm just wondering, and maybe even Novak himself doesn't know the answer to this question, are we seeing a slight 1% or 2% drop in that dialed-inness, if you like?
Yeah, I think that's a very fair point. The other thing is, I think what makes it so complicated is he feels he's got to play this reduced schedule now. That's his concession to age, is I can still play as well as ever or close to it, but I can't play as much. And it worked out last year. It really worked out in the sense that he took his breaks, took a nice long break after the U.S. Open all the way up to Paris-Bercy.
Yeah.
And he managed to, you know, without playing his best in Paris-Bercy and feeling sick most of the week, and he had stomach issues, but he got through the tournament. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so he was able to sort of, but now maybe he's questioning it a bit, is that, would it have helped, for instance, to have played in Dubai? I think it would have, frankly. Just to have had another tournament and a bunch of matches in prior to coming to Indian Wells, maybe this doesn't happen. Because he's asking a lot of himself. It's a big demand on himself to play that well in a reduced schedule. It's risky. It's risky in his way. And last year, I would never say he got away with it, because he deserved everything that he got. But he was able to make it work in his favor. Now maybe he'll reevaluate a little bit. It's hard to say, because we don't, as we said earlier, we don't know exactly why he pulled out of Miami. It's all conjecture, speculation, but we got to believe it's to peak on the clay in Paris, and it's just to turn his attention to the clay period now and wipe this one out of his mind and clear his head. So yeah, I see your point though. There's a part of him too that, to get back to your point, yeah, there's part of him that is so delighted with where he is in his career achievements and being two majors ahead of Rafa, and it's inconceivable that Rafa could catch him or pass him. Mm. And just having, you know, all the other achievements, the 8 year end number ones, the 420 or whatever it is right now, weeks at number one, so many things that he is that make him content. And he has made those passing remarks about, sometimes he asks himself, why does he want to put himself through this anymore? And then the final point is what you said. Because he loves the idea of these dynamic rivalries. So that was a great stretch last year to play Carlos at the French. Granted, it was a disappointing conclusion because of the cramping, but it was still a big match and a big win. Lose to him in narrowly at Wimbledon and then win the epic in Cincinnati. And that was very exciting for him, that he was so upset by the Wimbledon loss. He was very proud that he came back, beat Carlos in Cincinnati final, which gave him the confidence to win the U.S. Open. So that was a very satisfying year. And there is a part of him right now that is probably that inner voice that's saying, why do I need to even go on? I'd rather be with the family. I've done it all. I think I put myself in a position where most people are going to say I'm the greatest player of all time. And so do I really need to push myself and be away from my family this much and put myself through this, what sometimes must seem like an ordeal, which again gets back to your point. He'll always be excited about playing the slams.
Yeah.
But the rest of the tournaments, even some of the 1000s, are not going to spur him, get him as inspired as they once did. And even there, he's got his 40 Masters 1000s. So, you know, the targets are becoming, they're receding. I mean, there's just not as many of them left. Now, it's adding on. Move past Margaret Court and get that 25th major. Okay, if he closed in on it in Paris or Wimbledon, I think that would be exhilarating for him and might be enough to give him the emotional energy to get it done. But in some of these cases, as you just alluded to, he can't find that inspiration from within.
Olympic gold. I guess that's the other thing for him to be motivated about.
Right, but right.
Maybe we can talk about that a bit later on in the year. Steve, let's move on to the semifinals. Although, actually, I say let's move on to the semifinals that are obviously on the horizon, the men's single semifinals, I should add. Before we do that, I think we've got to give a quick mention to the bees that we saw last night. I mean, Steve, how long have you been covering tennis for? And have you seen anything like it?
Well, I've been covering for 50 years and been around it for 60 when go back to my days as getting immersed in the game as a fan at the age of 12.
Yeah.
No, I've never seen anything like it. I thought what was wonderful about it was especially Carlos, the amusement he had, rather than get agitated and say, get rid of those bees. I need to play this match. This is ridiculous. Uh-huh. He kind of had that grin on his face. He's, you know, part of it is, I think he's happy with how he's playing again. And he felt confident about this match. And the other was, look, there's nothing we can do about this, but this is amazing. And he even said afterwards, it's something I'll never forget. And that was the right attitude. And Zverev was a good sport about it, too. They knew that those people there were doing everything in their power to get them back to be able to resume the match. So, but no, I've never seen anything like it. It was an incredible sight, those bees swarming around. I worried about the fans, too, sitting in the stands. I suppose it didn't seem to put in danger them, but I worried about those spectators.
I did too initially, although it did seem like the bees were attracted by two or three things in the stadium, and it wasn't actually within the stands itself. But yeah, I know what you mean. But once I saw that the fans were not being evacuated, I was like, okay, it seems to be a bunch of bees in certain areas. And when we all, over the next couple of hours, became experts in what bees are up to and why they're there. And then, of course, we were focusing on this guy, Lance, a lot. He got his 5 minutes of fame, didn't he?
He did. Yeah, he enjoyed it. He was high-fiving people when he walked back into the stands. And yeah, I mean, I thought Carlos and Sasha were very, very appreciative of him and handled the situation very, very well. Because, I mean, it's a big match and you want to get on with it. You understand rain delays, but you don't understand bee delays.
Yeah, right. Okay. That leads us in, though, to the fact that Carlos was the person on the court, at least, who dealt with the whole situation best and was just outclassed Sasha in pretty much every department. The best of my knowledge, I don't think Carlos had to face a break point, on this slow court and his serve has been under scrutiny, I would say, in the last 6 months is pretty impressive. And he was just better than Zverev all over, right?
Yeah, John, I didn't think, to your last point, I didn't think, you're right, his serve was impressive, although the beauty of this court for him is it doesn't end up mattering that much. If he's got full confidence in his ground game, and his ball control and patience is up to the level it was yesterday, then he doesn't necessarily, I think the serve becomes more important on faster courts and different tournaments than this one. This reminds me of last year, the way he's starting to play right now, where he just was, it was probably his best, most efficient tournament of the year in many ways, and starting to look like that now. I thought he played an impeccable match. And in turn, here's Zverev, who's beaten him the last two times. He beat him in the year-end championships, beat him in Australia. Those were big wins. Mm-hmm. And it looked to me like the wind diminished his game. The wind in the slow court was just fatal to him. The wind, slow court, and Carlos's excellence, it was just too much. It was a three-way, those three factors just destroyed him. And you could see how it was kind of a desultory performance from him, but you can see why he was almost fatalistic about it, because he could see there was no way he was going to win on this day. He didn't have anything to hurt him with. It's been hard on all the players, by the way, because there have been so many cool days and cool evenings, slow courts, and then wind. The wind has picked up so much that all of those things make it very hard for the players. It's harder to hold serve. It's just harder work, period. I mean, Medvedev alluded to that after his win over Holger Rune. You have to sort of just get the job done. In other words, you're not going to play beautiful tennis in these conditions. So, and yet, that's what I guess makes Carlos's performance all the more remarkable, is he did. He played spectacular tennis yesterday in a way that I haven't seen anybody else do in this tournament to that level. I mean, waiting for his openings, hitting those forehand down the line winners, obviously using his speed, his alacrity around the court was astonishing. And that was another thing that was showcased yesterday. You see a sense that the ankle is no issue anymore. And physically he's feeling 101%. So having said that, I'm still leaning 51-49 sinner, right down to the wire in that match with not a lot of confidence. But I feel like Jannik, having not lost all year and also understanding the importance of this rivalry to him right now, and it will be a crucial rivalry for him over the next 10 years. So right now he really wants to cash in and exploit the fact that he's coming off a brilliant ending to last year, that he, since the middle of last year, he's been the better player. He's been better than Carlos. Carlos fell into a slump after Cincinnati. That's just when Sinner was starting to come round, the Great Fall, the Davis Cup, the Australian Open. So now, and he's beaten Carlos the last couple of times, but this one becomes a particularly important meeting for both of them. What maybe helps Carlos is he can feel kind of loose about it. He knows that most people are anticipating a Sinner win. Mm-hmm. They're not giving it to him on a goal.
Possibly in this rivalry. For the first time, it's probably expectation is on Sinner.
Yeah, exactly. So Carlos may try to make that work in his favor. On the other hand, it's easy to feel that way going in. They get into a tight match. I think you both players forget about that. It's like you just want to find a way to win on this day. There's so much at stake concerning the outcome of this contest for both players, which makes it so much fun. And I just can't imagine we get sort of a routine disappointing match. So it's always possible, but the confidence that Carlos has now, the incentive he has, Sinner wanting to keep his unblemished year going, it's got all the ingredients to be a great, great tennis match.
I mean, as you say, Sinner's yet to lose. And if he wins this match, you'd fancy him going deep or possibly even, winning in Miami. I think even Miami might be suited a bit more to Jannik than Indian Wells. But the interesting dynamic about this rivalry is that, as I sort of said before, I think before it's always been like, if Alcaraz absolutely brings it, even though he does seem to bring the best out in Jannik, and I'm thinking about 2022, 2023, you just felt as though Alcaraz would probably end up winning. And it was probably Wimbledon. I remember I was at that match, the four-setter in 2022. It was probably a year too early for Carlos on the grass. There was always kind of a thing. And then, okay, Carlos was facing match points in New York, but it was, again, there was this thing that we saw this Jannik Sinner on tour all year, and then we just see him really elevate his level and come alive against Carlos. And yet now, if Sinner brings his level, probably, if he brings his level that he's produced all year, anything that I've seen from Carlos since Cincinnati is not going to probably be enough.
I agree with that, you know, with some reservations. It's just, you know, that Carlos seems to be peaking again. I just think that the big difference now from all of the, you alluded to so many interesting matches that they played, that, you know, the 22 Wimbledon Sinner wins, and then Carlos escapes from match point down on his way to winning his U.S. Open title, his first major, and then they had a disappointing match last fall. Okay, it's going to happen once in a while. That great scrape in Miami. They played last
Miami
year.
Miami semifinal,
Yeah, exactly.
But and Indian Wells semifinal.
Indian Wells, and then Miami was a great match. The Sinner one where Carlos was cramping.
Yeah.
I just feel like the big difference, the reason I still just lean that ever so slightly to Sinner, is I think his serve is so much better since he changed it. Mm-hmm. Technically, over the last several 6 months, let's say, I think his serve is much better. So therefore, Carlos, who's got a great return, is going to be more hard pressed to break. And then just the way. And he just, I don't feel he misses as much in the rallies either. Everything, he's tightened everything up. There's no hole left, I think. And in the end, I think Carlos could maybe, I could see there were some of the matches that he won against Sinner where I felt like he could coax some errors. There were going to be a few little bad patches from Jannik. I don't think that happens now. So Carlos, to me, has to play, you know, maybe one of the best matches of his career to win. But on the other hand, I'm not shocked if he does it. Because right now I think he's feeling it again. That's what makes this so intriguing, is that he's feeling like the old Carlos and feeling like someone who feels he's ready to go to an even higher level. And he's also, he like Djokovic, we were talking about how Novak wants those, he relishes those rivalries and those, like he had going with Carlos, and they may resume it. And I think Carlos is the same way. He feels like this Sinner rivalry is going to be one of the defining aspects of his career. You know, he has enough respect for Sinner to know they could go back and forth a lot through the years, that it's never going to be a foregone conclusion. They're always going to push each other to the hilt. So you have that too. I feel like, you know, as I said, I just can't imagine it's not very tight. I think that Carlos, there won't be many breaks either, because Carlos, I expect to back up his serve as well as he has up until this stage of the tournament. Sinner, the thing about Sinner, tell me how you feel, John. Mm-hmm. I feel like, okay, he's not as flashy. He's never going to be the same crowd pleaser that Carlos is. But then again, nobody can match Carlos for charisma on the court and crowd pleasing characteristics. The ultimate shot maker. But Jannik is stingy. Jannik is at that stage now where he does not want to give much away. Jannik is the ultimate, is the ultimate professional right now, along with, you just feel like he's as dedicated to his profession as anybody out there right now. And he's thinking like a champion, and he's just shored up any of the old, whatever minor weaknesses he had, I think are gone now. You just simply have to play an extraordinary match to beat him. So I not as flashy, but in the end, maybe he just makes fewer mistakes. And he plays, and then of course, as usual, it will come down to which one of these guys is better on the big points, who rises to the occasion on the most important points of the match. But I don't think Sinner will be found wanting in that category either.
I've circled a couple of things on my little notepad here while you were sort of putting that to me. And you're not going to like one of them, because one of the things I circled was pull the trigger when it comes to Jannik. But the other one is kind of related, which is waiting for his openings, which is actually what you mentioned about Carlos. And I was thinking back to a year ago when actually in that Indian Wells tournament, but especially in the final against Medvedev. We all remember the serve and volley thing that he did then, but also I think he was just waiting for his chance and taking it. But I don't think there's anybody on tour right now, definitely not Carlos and probably not Novak, that right now that's actually better at waiting for that moment and then pulling the trigger. Because, you know, I think of the winner on Match Point in Australia, but I also think about the winner against Novak in the semifinal. In fact, I counted his match points. I was just focusing on his match points in Australia, and he hit a lot of winners, and a lot of them were on the forehand side. It was something like 4 out of 7 finished that way. It might have just been a quirk, but it was just like Jannik just knows exactly. He doesn't pull it too soon, not that often now. Like you said before, in the past, maybe a few cheap points would go the way of his opponent. But now it's like he's just got that timing in every sense of the word.
Perfectly. And I think the forehand, I just feel like the forehand is much better than it was. I used to feel it could let him down at critical moments. I remember against Rafa in the French Open and other instances where I felt like Zverev at the US Open, where it would start to fly in and where you felt like it wasn't holding up well under pressure. That's just not the case right now. So you really have to, beat him. But I think Carlos is in the mood and in the mode right now where he's going to be, it's going to be similar on his side of the net. These guys are going to have to really earn it against each other. And they know that going out there. I suspect that Darren Cahill will have a few ideas too for Sinner, you know, because he's seen so much of Carlos, not only in his coaching role, but in the television booth, that the scouting, I think, will come in very handy. Not to diminish Juan Carlos Ferrero. He'll have his own ideas on how to get Carlos prepared for this match. I do hope from Carlos's standpoint, John, that he doesn't lean too much. He hasn't had to this tournament. He's been playing well since dropping his first set of the event. He's played quite well, but I hope he doesn't lean too much on Juan Carlos during the match. I hope there's not too much bad, because we've seen that in the past, where I think it kind of got him into trouble. I feel like it's not healthy for him. It's better for him to do some of the thinking on his own and be a little more selective about looking over to Juan Carlos for encouragement or advice. So that'll be important too. While you notice with Cahill, you feel like Jannik looks over again. He's judicious about it, and he waits for big moments, and Cahill will shake the fist at him or yell something tactical, but it's more limited. It's not as free. That'll be another interesting part of this contest, but it could end up being, I mean, we saw an incredible final that you alluded to a few minutes ago with Sinner and Medvedev, the Australian final, and Jannik's climb back from 2 sets down. This may end up being the best match we've seen. It may end up being one of the best matches of the year. I hope I'm not getting my hopes up too high and expecting too much, but I can't see it any other way. I just cannot, because I think they're both so prime for the occasion. It's going to have the feeling of a final, don't you think?
Yes, I do. It does feel like a final before the final in many ways. And we will, of course, be touching on Medvedev, Tommy Paul in a moment. One final thing that basically supports your argument about the serve with Jannik. And even I was surprised by this at one point during the match with Lehecka yesterday. When Lehecka had 1 or 2 chances, was a bit loose on a few forehands that went long. And I think there can be some encouragement there that Carlos can take. But the serve, he's dropped serve, Jannik, once in this entire tournament, which, you know, he's not dropped a set, but he's also only lost his serve once, which on these sort of slow, gritty conditions, I know one or two people have been suggesting they might be a bit quicker this year, but that's mightily impressive.
Yeah, no, it is. And it's reminiscent of Australia, where I believe he dropped it twice prior to the match against Daniel in the finals, and obviously changed there. But no, and this was never the case with him in the past. It's really ample proof of just how much that serves improved. Also, the way he handles pressure, because he's very calm on break points. It's so routine to him now. He just does not get flustered, and he seems to raise his game almost every time. So he's forcing the other guy to come up with something extraordinary to break him at those pivotal moments. So that's a good stat you just brought up.
And flustered is another word that I've written down and then quickly circled, because I do think in the last 7 or 8 months, that is something that's happened to Carlos on when he's facing big points. And he's admitted it in his words to the press. I think it was just on the eve of the tournament in Indian Wells. He said that he does feel a bit more nervous now than he used to on when he's sort of 15, 30 down or he's got a breakpoint opportunity and realizing, okay, this is big. And I think that was good for Carlos to sort of just get that off his chest, you know, and perhaps that has helped him clear his head. Okay.
But John, don't you think it still gets back in this case to the fact that he's in the right state of mind and he knows that there's so much sinner talk. Exact opposite, by the way, despite the fact that he'd lost to him at Wimbledon in 2022 when he played him at the Open, we all were thinking this was going to be the Carlos moment. This was the breakthrough. This was going to be his first major. So he had to feel a certain amount of tension, and Sinner was the one trying to come at him as the underdog. And I think Carlos will enjoy that. That doesn't mean that he's automatically going to produce under pressure, but I think it will free him up to a degree, I believe.
Fingers crossed. Okay. The other semifinal, we have this expression in English about the Lord Mayor's show, but I don't think it's familiar in the US. It's basically when you have what I've described as potentially the final before the final. And I don't know. I was wondering about this about an hour ago before we spoke about the scheduling. I've got a hunch, not much more than that, that they'll go for Carlos Sinner first and then Medvedev Paul second. I think with one eye on European audiences, but also it's a Saturday, so they don't need to shift the bigger match to the evening or the later in the day slot. So I think with the European audience thrown in as well, you know, getting it a bit earlier in the day in California, I wouldn't be surprised if we have Sinner Alcaraz first. But whatever order they fall in, this after the Lord Mayor's show is basically like, you know, the big party happens, the eagerly anticipated thing, and then we get Daniel Medvedev against Tommy Paul. I hope that both matches are crackers. What are your thoughts on this encounter?
Tommy Paul, of course, as you know so well, John, he took advantage of that nice opening in the draw. He was going to have to play Novak in the round of 16. Instead, it was Nardi. He got the job done. Then he plays Rude. Nice win over Rude in a tight three-set match. So he's confident. He's had a good year all around since Australia. Disappointing loss to Kecmanovic in Australia. Since then, he's buckled down. He's won a tournament. He's rolling along nicely. I think we'll try to attack as much as possible. He's been happy with with his transition game and his volleying and talked a lot about watching tapes of Edberg and how much he loves Edberg's backhand volley. So he's trying to become more aggressive, and he's certainly going to have to do that because he's not going to wear Daniel down from the baseline as good as Tommy is. And he's terrific from the baseline. Mm. I mean, and we saw him beat Carlos last summer and then have another close match with Carlos after that win. Yeah. But that was a different kind of tennis, and he was able to feel like in the longer rallies he could coax errors from Carlos. It'd be much more difficult to do that with Daniel. Definitely. So I feel like Tommy can make it interesting. Tommy can make it relatively close. I just can't see him beating Medvedev. Medvedev looks very disciplined to me. I think he did a great job to turn the tables on Korda on a very cold, windy night, where I believe there were 15 service breaks across three sets.
Yeah.
And he managed to win that match. And Korda, of course, had beaten him in Australia and then again one more time after that. So he'd struggled with Korda. It was a good effort. I thought the Runa match, in miserable conditions, they both played scintillating tennis, all things considered. And Daniel came out top and straight. So I like his chances. I think, you know, he's bounced back very nicely. He had the loss to Humbert, but coming in here, but he's looked good here. And he's confident. I just feel like he believes that match is in his hands as good as Tommy Paul is. So I see something along the lines of, say, a 4-6 for Daniel, something like that. Maybe Tommy squeezes a set, but I can't see Tommy winning the two sets. I like Medvedev to meet Sinner or Alcaraz in the final. And I'm picking Sinner. So I see a repeat of the Australian Open final. I think, frankly, oddly, Daniel would prefer that. I don't think he would want any part of playing Carlos on this same slow court where he got demolished last year. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was a US Open. That US Open win for Daniel was impressive and it was inspired. Yep. And he caught Carlos at the right time and played his best tennis. But then He didn't do that well against him in the year-end championships. Granted, a meaningless round-robin match in Turin, but still not a great performance. It looked like Carlos once more had his number. So if Daniel to play him on this court, I don't like it. I think he does better against Sinner than he would do against Carlos. That's my feeling. But I certainly expect to see Medvedev in the final.
Yeah, because despite those four in a row losses that he's had to Jannik, some of them have been mighty, mighty, mighty close.
Oh, they one have.
One point either way, and we could be looking at an 8-2 head-to-head rather than 6-4. Regarding Tommy Paul, when you were mentioning about him maybe having a slightly different mindset, talking about the Edberg backhand volley and also the method of attacking, I was starting to just think about some of the semifinals he's had in the past in Canada and notably in Australia last year when he comes up against Novak. And there were one or two occasions in that match when I was like, you've got to do something a bit different here, Tommy, because if you're going to be playing from the baseline and just doing these rallies against, you know, the greatest of all time, especially in this dynamic, you're not going to win this tennis match. You may as well go down 2-1 and 2 and do something different. And I hope that perhaps he does that differently as well against Medvedev, because I think you're right. He could easily just fall into this spell with Daniil in a sort of backhand cross-court rally scenario, and then Daniil just pulls the trigger down the line and that's that.
Well, the other thing, John, don't you think that just, sorry to interrupt. It won't be that easy. In other words, Tommy's talked about how he feels in this tournament, unlike sometimes in the past where his ground game was his greatest strength. He feels like it's been the attacking that's been the best part of his game and maybe his ground game. So, I mean, he's, granted, thinking more that way, serving better than he used to. I just feel like in the end, Daniel's got just a little too much for him. Also, Daniel, my point about, to get back to what you were saying, Daniel will make it hard for Tommy to attack. Daniel keeps the ball so deep. And he passes so well. It moves so well. I just feel like, all things being equal, it's hard to see Medvedev losing. But if Tommy Paul can find a way to win that match, that will be a sign that he's not the same player that you just alluded to that played Djokovic, say, in the semis of the Australian last year and made a comeback from 5-1 down to 5-all in the first set, but then got beat, obliterated in straight sets. So he's had his moments, and it's certainly an opportunity, and I don't think he'll go out there with a lot of negativity. But I just think in the end, he's going to just be slightly outclassed. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I do. I have a similar vibe to you. I'm more than happy to disagree with you, Steve, but I do have a similar vibe to you on this occasion in that I think maybe two tight sets go in the way of Daniil. I think it's a fair point as well about some of these encounters that Daniil and Novak don't give you a chance to change the dynamic of the rally. If they're hitting the ball deep and accurately, what can you do? And that's what Tommy said in his press conference after that Novak semi, because he was confronted with that. I think one or two sort of experts, Craig O'Shaughnessy, I remember saying that he should be trying some serve and volleying and trying to change things up during that match with Novak. But he's like, well, what? I can't do that when Novak is getting so close to the baseline, you know, during the rally or hitting his returns of serve the way he does. And I do think a similar scenario will be occurring tomorrow with Daniil. Daniil's playing very well. You mentioned that defeat in Dubai. Tiny asterisk by that one in that I think he had some shoulder issues in that tournament. But he seems to be free of those right now, and he seems to be free in general. Those two matches, though, with Runa and Korda from Medvedev, there was a bit of a weirdness in some respects about both of them. And you mentioned the multiple breaks of serve with Korda. The Runa one was, there was that debate at the net as well, but it was kind of very difficult to gauge where that match was going because Runa made 27 unforced errors in that first set and two or three less of those. And that could have been very different. And there was moments when you thought, okay, Daniel's held serve here. He should be okay. And then suddenly he was losing his serve. And yeah. But there's again, some chinks of light for Tommy, but like you, I do see Daniel as a warm favorite.
No, I agree with you, by the way, what you're saying about the Runa match. There were real opportunities for him. And he was the one I thought the best one was when he had 3-2, 15-40 to go up 4-2 in that first set. It would have made such a difference. He made a couple of mistakes on the next two points. Daniel was rock solid, but Runa pressed a bit. And had he broken there and gotten himself a lead, things could have been different. Then in the second set, he had 2-love with a game point for 3-love. That was a critical game. And Daniel ran off four games in a row to go up 4-2 and ran out and won the match. So Yeah, that was very hard fought. But that, again, that's so typical of Medvedev. He's such a, he's a very underrated competitor, you know, because he especially when he's in this state of mind, John, we're not getting the frantic Daniel Medvedev that we've seen, you know, sporadically in the past, who's constantly kind of venting to his corner, to his coach, and playing the role of the victim. No, he's just going out and playing tennis right now and competing the way he can when he's at his best. So that's why, again, that I like his chances so much against Tommy Paul, you know, to get to another final here.
We haven't seen that from Daniel, have we? I remember there was at least one, but maybe two instances with him really aggressively shouting at his box.
Right.
And on one occasion, his coach walked out. I remember that in Australia. And yeah. I think that was the last time we saw anything of that level. And yeah, hats off to him for that.
No, and he seems to have made a pact with himself, if I may say. You know, you talked about in Australia that he wants to change that side of his court personality. And he realizing that he's only hurting himself by getting so angry and wasting that energy, and that it really is up to him too. The idea of sort of venting to your coach as if it's your coach's fault. And of course we're going to have Gilles Simon come into the picture soon. You know, that's going to help him as well. But I like the idea that he's got this commitment to trying to remain calmer on the court, and that he'll do himself more justice that way too.
Cool. So I think Steve and I are in agreement. I make Yannick a very, very, very marginal, you know, favorite, but, you know, very few outcomes would surprise me. I mean, I think probably a 2-1 win for either player would surprise me, but, you know, I can, you know, two amazingly tight sets or two, three humdinger sets, as we were saying. The humdinger is like a roller coaster scenario.
Yeah.
That will happen there. And the one I'm more clear on, though, is unfortunately Tommy Paul's sort of semi-final run, as he proved in Australia and also Canada in 2023. I think this will just be a step too far for him.
Yeah, but look, we'll see what happens. I feel like it would be fun, by the way. I would like to see Medvedev Sinner go at it again, given what happened in Australia and Daniel's disappointment and the exhilaration for Yannick winning his first, and chance for Medvedev to sort of try to swing the rivalry back in his favor after losing the last four, and a chance for Sinner to just keep his unbeaten streak going. That would be fun. Carlos and Medvedev would be fun as well, but I'm afraid it would not be terribly enjoyable for Daniel Medvedev.
Right. Because
in that instance, I would pick Alcaraz in straight.
Yeah. Exactly. That would be my concern. I mean, Medvedev maybe can able to bring it like he did in New York last year, if that's the final. But yeah, it feels like a sort of a three horse race. No disrespects to Tommy Paul right now, but hey, listen, Tommy, prove us wrong and give us an unbelievable semi final and emerge the winner. And I will hold my hands up and say I got it wrong.
Well, John, it's been a lot of fun. I always enjoy talking tennis with you.
Wonderful, Steve. Thanks for coming on once again. And now I'm pretty confident it'll be Grand Slam summertime when we touch base. And but thanks again for coming on.
Thank you, John. I enjoyed it.
Wonderful.
Sports Social Podcast Network.